Hello and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and today I'm speaking with Roberto Ramon Lint Sagarena, author of Aztlan and Arcadia, Religion, Ethnicity, and the Creation of Place, published by New York University Press in 2014. Dr. Lint Sagarena is an associate professor of American Studies at Middlebury College, where he teaches courses on American literature and culture, Latino studies, and religion in the borderlands. Professor Lint Sagarena is the director of the Center for the Comparative Study of Race and Ethnicity, and his research and teaching interests focus on the role of religion and religious rhetoric in the formation of racial, ethnic, and regional identities in the Americas, and with a particular attention paid to social relations resulting from inequality. Hello, Roberto, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate you being on and taking on the time for us today. So I was wondering if you could begin our conversation today by telling us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure. Well, I'm currently living in Vermont, but I'm a native Californian. I grew up on the Central Coast of California, and my mother is Mexican, and my father was a Midwesterner from Detroit. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up going back and forth between Mexico and the U.S., and what else can I tell you? I was a very poor student. I dropped out of high school after 10th grade and was rescued by a very lengthy career in community college mm-hmm. in California. And from there, I went to University of California at Santa Cruz. And then in a moment of complete culture shock, I ended up doing my graduate work at Princeton, which is about as different from Santa Cruz as you could possibly get.
Right.
And it was there that I really launched into some of the interests that led to this book.
Gotcha. Thank you for that. And, you know, I think I found a neat little bio on you online. I think it was produced by the college that you're mm-hmm. at. Could you talk to us a little bit more about that kind of that transformation you experienced in community college, where you kind of really got things together and were inspired? And then, I mean, that's a big jump, right, from dropping out of high school
jump, yeah.
to
community
college going on.
Yeah, well, you know, this sounds I don't know how it sounds actually, but what my experience really taught me was that all it takes is one individual to really make a difference in a student's life.
Right.
My high school counselors all told me, you'll never go to a four-year school, especially if you take the GED out, you know, you're basically doomed. I didn't take community college that seriously at first because I never thought I would go to a four-year school, but I was curious and wanted to keep my brain going. And so I did poorly in the classes there at first, too, until I met an advisor who basically explained to me what I needed to do to get into the UC system. And once the path was laid out for me and I saw what I needed to do, the transformation was almost overnight. I hit the books hard, and I saw what could be done. And fortunately, at that point, I'd been working long enough that I saw school as a form of work, and a very easy form of work compared to kitchen work, which I'd been doing. And so that was where the real moment of transformation came and sort of hit the ground running and never looked back. And I've been really grateful for the moments when individuals have helped me. And I hope that in my career, there have been moments where I've helped others.
Great, great. Thank you for discussing that. I just, it resonates with me. I got my start, at least in higher education and community college as well. And, mm-hmm. You know, had a, you know, just, I just didn't apply myself in high school so much to where, you know, community college did become finally when I got my act together, right? That redemptive yeah. kind of moment where I could
exactly.
finally, you know, salvage, if you will, right? My academic pursuits. And,
yep.
and I agree. It was, I had a couple advisors there or, you know, professors. And I think that's one of the great things about community college. A student has the opportunity to really work with professors one-on-one. Of course, they have to be, you know, very proactive in doing that. But,
yeah.
But, you know, you don't have some of the other, what is it? Just the size, perhaps necessarily of a major college or research institution, and then TAs and all that kind of get in that way. It's directly professor yeah. to student, right?
Right.
And it was there that one of my professors put it in my head that said, "Hey, you know, you could pursue a PhD." And
yeah.
I thought it was
yeah.
crazy. And I thought,
yeah.
are you seriously? That's I didn't even think about that. You know, so I appreciate that again. And there's a shout out to all those great community college professors out there
that are doing some good. They really are the front lines and make a huge difference in social gatekeeping, you know, and making opportunities available to folks.
And of course, there are a lot of those at standard four-year institutions. So I don't want to.
I think though there's we were lucky. I'm speaking for you now as well as myself, but I think it's there's a certain luxury to having been an adult for a while before you go to college.
And I agree. Spend
your time trying to figure out what it means to be an adult, and you can just really engage the materials.
I agree too. Great. Well, also, could you say a couple things? I noticed that your academic background, at least your degrees, that is, are in art history, philosophy, and religion. So it's it's a nice eclectic mix. Can you talk a little bit about that and what spurred those interests?
My interest in religion came from the cultural experience of growing up in California and in northern Mexico with a particularly pious mother, Mexican Catholic, and trying to understand the difference between the cultures of the United States, the Catholic cultures of the United States, and those of Mexico. This is where I started, not where I ended up necessarily. And it was a curiosity about that that led me to pursue religious studies. And I transferred to Santa Cruz into their religious studies program, but the year that I arrived, they had just closed it.
That would have
been a bummer, except that it allowed me to double major in art history and philosophy and basically do the same thing with the same faculty, just not within the rubric of religious studies.
Gotcha.
And I was able to stay at Santa Cruz a little bit longer and take more classes, so that was good.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And then from there, I was fortunate enough to get into the religion program at Princeton, and the reason I wanted to go there was my principal advisors were both people that I really admired in terms of their way that they were able to write about complicated issues around race, ethnicity, religion, identity, and that would be Al Ravito and David Carrasco. And so anyway, I felt sort of blessed to have that door open. And once I got to the East Coast, I'd never been east of Texas before I got there. Pretty provincial Westerner. It really gave me the opportunity to think about home.
Gotcha.
And how home was constructed when I was looking at the East Coast through the eyes of a foreigner.
I totally agree with that. I mean, just that concept of leaving home can really make you think about, the place that you come from and, how people, the environment that you grew up in. I mean, I remember I grew up in Southern California as well. And it wasn't until I left Southern California for a few years. And it wasn't very far. I was just in the, Mountain West. And, but in a much less, it wasn't a, very diverse metropolitan region like either San Diego or Los Angeles particular. And it was just shocking to see how people responded to me, the way I looked and just the name of what my name was and the assumptions that carried. And it really got me thinking, as you just pointed out about where I came from and what goes into all of that, the role of identity and making place and whatnot, So certainly. And it sees that experience certainly carried over into the book. Your interest with religion and placemaking. So can you talk to us a little bit about how you came to write Atlan and Arcadia?
I can, this is dark secrets revealed here, but this was even before graduate school. This was when 87 had passed, and I left California, and I just felt like this place is really a hateful, horrible place. So I wrote the book. At least my initial impulse was sort of the opposite of a love letter to California. It was more like, how did this place end up being such a horrible place? And then once you start thinking about it and realizing, well, the California is one that was built on war and conquest, and it's something that we bury deep, and we don't talk about much. Having grown up in the late 60s, early 70s with a father who was heavily involved with Mecha, I had a sense of counter-critiques, mm-hmm. the dominant way of thinking about the Southwest, and in Southern California in particular. So it really was emotionally driven. Mm-hmm. It was my emotional response to the place. And it was a learning experience about not only California, but my understanding my own identity, having grown up in both Mexico and California, and how the two places relate, and trying to make myself whole, I guess, is really part of the project. I mean, and that sounds all very like a psychoanalytic project, but there is a certain bit of healing that can come from trying to gain a sense of where one came from, and
right.
in deep ways, and deep critical ways too.
Yeah, and I think it also speaks to this type of disjuncture that I guess we tend to experience at some point of our lives, where you're confronted with an experience like what came out of 187, mm-hmm. and what you'd experienced previously, or what mm-hmm. and that goes from what you'd been taught from school, mm-hmm. what you'd seen and learned mm-hmm. in the home, mm-hmm. That's something that definitely shook me when I entered college. I hadn't mm-hmm. gained much of a sense of, as you just mentioned, the deep connections in history between California and the broader Southwest and Mexico, right? And mm-hmm. Even now, I think that's something that's still, even as I look at my daughter's history textbooks, of course, mm-hmm. I police mm-hmm. them like crazy. I know I shouldn't do that, but anyways, they've gotten better. The school curriculum's gotten better, I think, particularly in California history and talking about certain mm-hmm. things. But that sense that you just mentioned of the connection between the two places, and mm-hmm. how deep and long and historical and conflicted it is, I think is something that definitely needs to be teased out a bit more. Particularly I think in K through 12 education in various ways. So,
yeah.
And this book really gets at that. So,
thank you. That's very generous of you. That was part of the hope. And part of the hope was also to look at this from the Mexican side too, mm-hmm. because, just as the United States denies, its Latin American past in terms of wars of conquest and, obviously, intervention for almost two centuries now. There's a Mexican denial of, mm-hmm. Or there has been a Mexican denial of, I think this has diminished somewhat over time, but real critique of Mexico de Fuera, and at least initially of Pachucos and Chicanos, right, as being traitors,
right,
and being people without a culture. So the critique comes from all sorts of different sides, and trying to make sense of it and show folks on both sides of the fence that, hey, wait a minute, you're intertwined here.
Right.
don't think that you're completely separate, because you're not.
Right. And so with the book, you then, you mentioned your deep interest in religion, and that becomes mm-hmm. pretty much your central focus, on the role of religion and, how it's intertwined with placemaking and mythology and, creating histories and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that the place that religion is central in this book is in showing the way that the religious rhetoric the language of traditions helps to inculcate particular ways of whitewashing history, of forgetting particular types of history,
mm-hmm.
And also of creating counter narratives with the end of the book. But religion becomes something that legitimizes in a way that few things can, and so the book doesn't really have a theological focus, but it really does. What I tried to do anyway was really look at the way that actors made use of religion, rather than looking at religion and religious practice per se. Although arguably, appropriating history could be thought of as a religious practice.
Gotcha. Right. Yeah. Well, and the title speaks to that, I think, a little subdued, but definitely clearly to me, in putting the concept of Aztlan and Arcadia right up the front there. You know, how, you know, both of these are these kind of, you know, have this, these mythological ideas and notions that form what they are, right? And their importance. And the chapters of the book lay this out and carry it throughout history. So let's get into a discussion of these chapters.
Sure.
The first one, you begin by describing the interrelated narratives of conquest and reconquest employed in the push for both Mexican independence from Spain and then later in America's westward expansion, is the United States, of course, you know, westward expansion into northern Mexico. So those involved in these nationalist projects were myriad, right? We had clerics, there's historians, soldiers, writers, settlers themselves. And they recognized, you point out, and I loved this quote, that, quote, owning place requires owning history, unquote. So will you discuss the use of, you've mentioned religious rhetoric, so let's discuss the use of religious rhetoric and iconography by both the early 19th century Criollo revolutionaries in Mexico and then also the mid-19th century American expansionists and how they laid claim to California and sought to refashion the region's history to coincide with their vision of, the, of its future.
Sure, yeah. Well, on the Mexican side, I guess it would be easy to start with Manuel Hidalgo, right, and the Grito de Dolores and the Banner of Guadalupe and the independence movement starting under the image of Guadalupe and how that becomes canonized and turned into a particular nationalist narrative in Mexico where you end up with Guadalupe sort of squaring off with other versions of Mary, you know, La Conquistadora. So the Spaniards were having La Conquistadora. the Mexicans had Guadalupe. And so religion is used, even though you're talking about essentially the same saint or intercessor on opposite sides of a national frame. But because Guadalupe was an American apparition, by American, I mean that broadly, of the Americas.
Right.
She became a great vehicle for claiming religious connection to place. She appeared to an indigenous man in the Americas and criollos, that is to say, the descendants of Spaniards in the Americas, were able to lay claim to that, though they may or may not have had indigenous blood in them. I mean, blood doesn't necessarily tie one to claims of place at this point. It's about the narrative of Americanness, and again, Americanness broadly, not in terms of the United States. And so this is very anti-Spanish, anti-Gachupin. Que viva el buen gobierno y muerte a los gachupines, you know, long live the government and death to the Spaniards. comes a battle cry for Mexicans. And making the country Aztec and talking about resurrecting the Aztec Empire, even by the children of Spaniards, becomes a national project, which is just as imaginative as that of American Protestants who are coming and seeing themselves as being as industrious and as pious as the Spanish Franciscan priests. And there's a crucial distinction there. All of this is starting up right after the Mexican War, which is a moment of great nativism and anti-Catholicism in the United States.
Right.
But by really focusing on the Franciscan identity of these priests as opposed to their Catholic identity, they're able to do some political acrobatics and embrace the Catholic past and ultimately Americanize it over the course of the next, you know, 50 to 60 years and lay claim to the place by sharing the industriousness and the presumed moral superiority and racial superiority of Anglo whites, and as I say in the book, and others have said, it's this idea of walking in the footsteps of the padres, of the fathers,
right,
that ultimately become the underpinning for American claims to the Southwest, and also the creation of the Southwest. That's something that was crucially important to me, and it may be an obvious point, but those of us who grew up in Southern California are used to buildings that look like Taco Bells.
You know? Right.
And so really getting at the idea that, wait a minute, it wasn't always like this.
Right.
And mm-hmm. this was something that was constructed in order to create a region within the United States, just mm-hmm. as the South creates its emblems and just as New England has its own particular architectural vocabulary. The Southwest needed something to make it an identifiable American, and by American in this time, by this term, I mean part of the United States region.
Right.
So.
What I appreciate is how you bring up the the aspect of anti-Catholicism that was really quite widespread, you know, throughout the early 19th to middle of the early to mid 19th century, and a lot of that gets lost in our in the history of race, and you know, we talk about the sectional divide and particularly the War of Mexico, and a lot of that is racial analysis is used in that, and well deserved. I just appreciate, and I think it's really interesting and point of view to point out that this is also a time of that, a very strong anti-Catholicism, and yet these Anglo-Protestants are able to envision this Christian kinship, right, with Franciscan missionaries that allowed them to, gain a sense of mission and moral authority, if you will, to the colonization, to westward expansion.
Right.
And part of this was envisioning the colonization, the early colonization of California by Spain as something that was strictly religious, right? That's something that that westward expansion is kind of tied into, and also, American clerics and whatnot, right?
Yeah. And that's something that I hope the book made a contribution with, is a real focus on how strongly religious rationales were employed in claiming place. And by that, I mean that Americans saw the Franciscan colonization of California as being completely religious, and denying the secular aspect of it, the fact that this was, creating a frontier for northern Mexico, to defend northern Mexico. And by ignoring or downplaying or criticizing the secular component of settlement in California by Spanish citizens and then Mexican citizens, or should I say Spanish subjects and Mexican citizens, there was less of a break. There could be a claim of religious continuity, even mm-hmm. though there was political discontinuity.
Right. No, and that's a powerful connection, and it's. I think it speaks to the. The mental acrobatics that one needs to perform if you're supposedly in this this emerging nation, this democratic nation, which the United States has a deep history and it promotes right from its past, that we were mm-hmm. it was a democratic republic, and this is the early part of that very national mm-hmm. growth, and mm-hmm. and so with all the the notions of democracy that underlay the formation of the United States government and its spread, this again is a type of acrobatics that had to be made, right, in order mm-hmm. to justify such a sweeping move and an mm-hmm. aggressive really push into Mexico for mm-hmm. no other reason rather than a real seizure of territory, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And spanning the continent for trade and opening trade to the Pacific and
exactly.
all the other benefits of empire.
You know? Exactly. And that those were critical aspects of both of these expansionist and projects, both with Spain. It was a key part of it. Of course, its mm-hmm. colonization worked a little bit differently, but there was that very strong mm-hmm. both economic and militaristic security aspects of it, right? Mm-hmm. So, and that definitely comes across very well in this chapter.
Yeah, one of the things that I found intriguing was that many of the American historians who celebrated the Spanish past and the Spanish settlement and conquest of the northern frontier was incredibly well received in Spain. Mm-hmm. And it really was embraced by Spaniards as evidence of the greatness of Spanish history, sort of a longing for a lost empire, right?
Right.
That shows that the Spaniards were, in fact, on this moral mission to civilize, as it's sort of whitewashing of mission history, right?
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, there's a strange connection that happens with the reception in Spain. And all of this also has something to do with constructions of whiteness, I think, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, both for the Spaniards, but also for Anglo-Protestants as they construct the Southwest. One of the things that struck me about moving to the East Coast and looking at home is that on the East Coast, I saw so many more hyphenated identities among whites, Irish,
mm-hmm.
American, you know, Polish American. So ethnic identity and whiteness played out in a different way than what I saw in
right.
California, where whiteness was just sort of whiteness. I mean, certainly there will be pockets of people identifying with a particular national background
right.
Who identifies white. But westward expansion seemed to allow immigrants coming into New York or other entry points to the United States from Europe, a chance to just become plain white.
Exactly.
Plain,
right.
It allowed for some upward social mobility in that sense.
All right. Right. Mm-hmm.
They entered into a place with a little bit of a clearer canvas in terms of European identity.
Right. And there's a deep history behind that. I think there's been a lot of great work done on that, right? From mm-hmm. Irish migrants to San Francisco leading
yep.
anti-Chinese campaigns, right? To,
yep.
you know, the Midwesterners and New Englanders that moved to, you know, slipped into Southern California
mm-hmm.
With the, you know, growth of Los Angeles and whatnot. And that's what this book a lot of touch on is this recreation of place. And
mm-hmm.
That's a great point. And I think so. American, right. Westward expansion definitely, you know, plays a critical role in that broadening of the concept of whiteness, you know, from mm-hmm. the very confined, you know, Anglo-British mm-hmm. kind of conception to a much broader concept over time. So, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to move into the first couple of chapters cover mostly from the mid-19th century to the end of the 19th century. And I wanted to jump just due to time constraints, into
sure.
the initial decades of the 20th century. Cause
mm-hmm.
this is where, you know, Southern California at least really, you know, starts to enter into this, modern industrial era, as does Mexico. They both, mm-hmm. there's some similarities and some differences. So, you know, both as a result of both the gold rush and the U.S. war with Mexico, migrants and finance capital flooded, you know, this what was formerly northern Mexico and now, you know, California and the American Southwest. So in this process, the region experienced a real blistering pace of industrialization, urbanization, mm-hmm. and social and political transformation. In Mexico, this seemed to come to a head with the, you know, where it basically the outbreak of civil warfare,
mm-hmm.
Right? So all these tensions kind of really just could no longer be constrained in certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
However, in California particularly, civil war in Mexico, but then also a reconstructionist effort. And, mm-hmm. you know, the United States had gone through its civil war, and that's mm-hmm. what, you know, the whole industrialization of the West was really mm-hmm. part of this reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, we hear it from a north-south range, but from the West, right, it was a matter of
right,
how do we incorporate
right.
these Western territories. And so there's
right.
a reconstruction all of its own going on in California and
mm-hmm.
Towards the mid to late 19th century. And so
mm-hmm.
the third chapter of the book brings us to really the beginning of the 20th century, right, where
mm-hmm.
You know, we start to have this really, we're getting massive migration that it is, and I'm talking about not just Mexican migration, that's a traditional
mm-hmm.
sense that people hear the word nowadays, but I'm talking about white migration right from the Midwest and from New England
mm-hmm.
to the Southern California region. So we
mm-hmm.
discussed how the Spanish heritage of Greater Mexico was either embraced or shunned by California
mm-hmm.
boosters or post-revolutionary Mexican nationalists during
mm-hmm.
like these years, 1910, 1920s and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk about that a little bit more? How was the different ways, right? So it kind of turned two different ways in these regions
yeah.
as to the
yeah,
the,
no, no,
the
yeah, absolutely.
To,
I think that on the American side, things became more and more codified, and really became I mean, you start to see the creation of a particular sort of cultural hegemony that is inculcated, you know, from fourth grade curricula on, in terms of understanding the past and the ways that we've talked about that really go back to the 19th century. But on the Mexican side, you have this moment of that's another golden era for indigenismo following the Porfiriato. And you have the emblems of that indigenismo brought into the United States. There was a great show in the Latino Museum in L.A. In the 90s, and it was called Patria Portátil. And it was an exhibit of calendars, chromo calendars that portrayed Aztec warriors holding Aztec princesses next to in the Valley of Mexico, and all these kind of things that we, you know, understand as being almost a sort of Mexican kitsch now, and how those became the emblems of nationalism that were brought into this region that had been painted with the Spanish brush, or repainted, I should say, with the Spanish brush by Americans. That was a moment that, you know, in terms of the way that we think about Mexican history, or Mexican American history, pardon me, precedes a moment that we often talk about as being assimilationist, and the rise of LULAC and in the 50s, and the turn away from Mexicanness. But as many scholars have shown now, that didn't really go away. And then in the 60s, we see a real explosion of it with new waves of immigration and just a complete transformation of the region that, again, correlates to events in Mexico City with the Olympics of 68 and the discovery of the Coyoacán stone and a new form of rebellious nationalism that embraced the indigenous past and tried to reclaim it from the dominant state. The way that the state tried to use that past in one way was sort of turned against them, and then that was brought to the United States and became central to the Chicano movement of the 60s and early 70s.
And that's what I found interesting in this chapter. I'm going to go back to California's Hispanophilia in a little bit, but right now I just want to talk a little bit about the rise of the muralists, and the mural is this type of reform. I think you presented as reform through like art, through public art, that emerged in this post-revolutionary Mexican period. Can you talk a little bit about that more about the muralists themselves and how their art form fit into that project of reimagining Mexico?
Absolutely. Well, starting with Los Tres Grandes de Mexico, the three great muralists and their work abroad in the United States as they lived in exile, it started a tradition of ethnic Mexican art, public art in the United States. But one thing that I didn't flesh out as fully as I would have liked in this book was the influence of African-American murals and muralists on Mexican or Chicana muralists in the 70s, because there are deep connections there, and you see an explosion of works, and really beginning in the late 60s and really taking off in the early 70s, people that are household names now, like Judy Baca, are painting the streets. And I guess the point that I was really trying to make with a focus on muralism was that the Mission Revival architecture that I claimed was how Anglo-Americans were able to claim space and tell a history by claiming this, and in the way that space is claimed through the architecture. The murals provide the opportunity to tell a completely different story, a countering story, a story that allows for and argues for visually the legitimate presence of ethnic Mexicans.
Right.
Now, you know,
right.
Obviously people from all over Latin America, you know, there's certainly murals with a focus on Central American themes and peoples now,
right,
as demographics shift in the region.
And these murals, I mean, they were initially these three great muralists, as you say, mm-hmm. they were embraced by the Mexican state, right? They were actually mm-hmm. funded mm-hmm. by them through like a public mm-hmm. education initiative. Mm-hmm. I might have missed this in the book. Where did that exactly come from? Where did that idea come from? Muralism itself uh-huh. did in Mexico, was there some other experience that either got Vasconcelos to see that this would be an appropriate, you know, form of public outreach or education during this time, or? Mm-hmm.
As you say, José Vasconcelos, as Secretary of Education for a few years, saw murals as being a very powerful form of pedagogy, especially when you're dealing with a population that's largely illiterate, mm-hmm. and you're trying to school in a particular narrative of a history and a celebration of the indigenous past in the way that the post-revolutionary state did in Mexico. One of the characters that is, he's sort of a very, he slips in and out of the narrative, but he's an odd character, but important in this moment, I think, is Dr. Apple, mm-hmm. Who is a Mexican painter who is very accomplished, but he learned a lot of his craft by studying among fascists in Europe and seeing how muralism was employed in rising fascist movements, especially in Italy.
Oh, wow.
And so he brought that back to Mexico. So the beauty of this is that nobody's hands are ever clean.
Right.
So the murals that now we think of as being countercultural in the United States, we can trace back to an aesthetic that we would not want to associate them with, maybe,
in terms
of Italian fascism, right? So they have a long history of people understanding the power, and there's also a long history of it as ethnic and art used for racial uplift
right.
in the United States as well.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. I want to get back to, because that's the counter side to California's Hispanophilia, right? That mm-hmm. that really mm-hmm. just, you know, reaches a kind of pinnacle in this 1910-20s era, you know, of Los mm-hmm. Angeles. Los Angeles is in 1920 hits about 1 million people, I believe, right? Mm-hmm. So it's mm-hmm. becoming very urbanized. It's rising as a metropolitan city of, you know, in its own right, or at least it's trying to envision itself that way, and it's really trying to modernize itself, creating new buildings and all this stuff. And so really interesting, you know, along this push for, you know, city modernization with the building of, you know, industry infrastructure and whatnot, and mm-hmm. the new city hall and all those things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is you have this kind of, you know, just very romantic, you know, quixotic look to the past, into the Spanish and mission past that emerges in California. And you really make this great point of how this, The Spanish fantasy past that emerges among Anglo Protestants that are, you know, migrants themselves or transplants to LA, that it forms this type of Southern California. I'm probably going to butcher this word, right? Ecumenism. Is that right?
Ecumenism, but yeah.
Ecumenism?
You were close. You're good enough.
Sorry. I've read that word like 1,000 times and I've, you know, never heard it pronounced.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So can you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah, I know. This gets back to that earlier point of Anglo-Protestants being able to overcome their prejudice of particular Catholics.
Right.
Spanish Catholics in particular. Mexican Catholics still, you know, not so much.
Right.
But the religiosity of Mexican Catholics is often critiqued. It's not as not being as pious or as true and pure as that of the Franciscans, who are mm-hmm. really Protestantized in the way that they're presented, and equated, I mean, literally equated with the Puritans as being West Coast Puritans.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But and here again, this has to do with the creation of region. These are the Puritans are these dour, unhappy people. This is on the East Coast, but the Franciscans knew how to live, but they were still industrious and pious. So that mm-hmm. goes with the creation of Southern California and the Southwest as being a place of leisure and of affluence and of not being sort of mm-hmm. staid like New England. Claiming the Catholic past really is central to the creation of a particular vision that's saleable.
Right, and this being done by Anglo-Protestants, right?
Anglo-Protestants, it's really wild when you read a lot of the pamphlets from some of the centennial celebrations of some of the missions. Most of the people talking are Protestants, and the Catholic priests of the time think this is fabulous. They see this as being real acceptance of it, so we've arrived.
Right.
You know, Americans are no longer seeing us as foreigners.
Getting an influx of money to rebuild churches, right?
I mean, absolutely, yeah, uh-huh. right, yeah. So for Catholics that identify as, or would be identified as white, or would self-identify as white, this is a great thing. But for others, the ecumenism doesn't, not only does it not transcend racism, it in fact, you know, reinforces
right.
this idea of Mexicans as being counter to the industriousness of the Spaniards because of their, all the racist tropes that we're all familiar with of laziness and, you know, indolence and all these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, you have this back and forth of both. Transcending difference and also reinscribing it.
Right. And I hadn't thought about that in so much in that way as, you know, as Hispanophilia is kind of as creating a whitening process, if you will. Like you said, for mm-hmm. the Catholics that identified as white, you know, that could mm-hmm. identify as white, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think
mm-hmm.
that's a very interesting a point, and it's not something I'd really thought about much more. But as you were just talking, it seems like right it became this emergent form of this bridge between Southern California Anglo Protestants and white Catholics created this mm-hmm. type of a whitening agent, if you will.
Yeah, and what's interesting too is that a lot of the older elite families, the Californios,
mm-hmm.
Also very much. Played a part in this,
right?
And there's been some great work written on the Californios, but they participate in the celebration as well because they become part of this great narrative of they were the ones who had these huge ranches and really knew how to live, but ultimately somehow the Mexicans get blamed for the decline of the ruling elites. In California, even though really it's the American conquest that puts them
right.
out of business and is oppressive, right? But it's being allowed to be white by being a Californio as opposed to a Mexican that
right.
I think is crucial there.
When you mentioned in this third chapter, a number of examples that you know push this mission revival kind of movement and preservationist movement. You know, you talk about Charles Fletcher Loomis, the Landmarks Club. The building of the El Camino Real, is it Morris's Riverside Mission Inn, or is it Norris? What's his name? I forget his name.
Miller,
there you go. Sorry, I busted both of those names. Miller, that's right, Frank Miller. And so you talked about some of these things which have been discussed in some other literatures through a different lens, though. But something that I read, and I don't know if I missed this somewhere else, but I thought was just fascinating, was the transformation of Santa Barbara. You know, I had just mm-hmm. always assumed, even though, I mean, I've read a lot of California history,
yeah,
but
yeah.
And maybe in my very quick readings of some things, I missed this fact, but that blew me away. I didn't realize that mm-hmm. that Santa Barbara once was this very kind of New England-looking
yeah.
town, had this very New England-ish landscape, and then
yeah.
Voila, you know, not so much voila, but now it's like the pinnacle, right,
of yeah, yeah.
this Spanish, both the mission revivalism and Spanish revivalism that California went through, right?
Yeah, and also in terms of class, you know, you think of Montecito and enclaves like that, right? You know, that are but Santa Barbara became this strange place where you'll find that a lot of New England, principally families that had some sort of scandal, would send their scandalized family member to Santa Barbara. So it was a way of putting people out of the way of the social life of New England. You know, this could be a pregnancy out of wedlock or you know, eccentric, you know, people or whatever. But you end up at this town, and I was really surprised too to find that Helen Hunt Jackson was completely uninterested in Santa Barbara because it was so stuffy and New England looking.
Right.
Another piece that this New England town had was it had a Chinatown too, and there are letters at the Huntington that you can find that describe the destruction of the Chinatown as part of the recreation of Santa Barbara as a Spanish place, this elite place of luxury and affluence. Santa Barbara is amazing in that it was able to do it so quickly.
Right. Well, the earthquake, as you point out, helped out, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Earthquake leveled the town. That kind of helped things out.
Yeah, and it's also interesting to see how people in Santa Barbara who are doing this recreation are in conversation with developers in Florida too.
Really?
The same thing at the same time. Yeah, and. I'm forgetting the name. I want to say Gables. Affluent communities in Florida that are emerging at the same time that are playing with the same sorts of things. Okay, so what kinds of lamps should we make it mandatory to have on your house so that you have a uniform style that speaks to this imagined?
Yeah, no, that was the point you make, right? This was in the city code. They actually coded like how this rebuilding process was going to look, and it had to fit the Spanish Revival look and feel that they wanted in the town, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah, no, it's a wholesale thing. Yeah, no, it's really amazing, and it just goes to show you how things that we take for granted actually have strange and intricate histories.
Definitely. Yeah. We've been mentioning it throughout, but of course, there's an underside to all of Southern California's Hispanophilia, right? And perhaps no one articulated this better than Kerry McWilliams in the middle of the 20th century, right? You mentioned his 1946 expose, Southern California, an Island on the Land, which when I read it in college, that blew my mind. It completely shifted my historical interest and focus, right? It's where I became a California historian and all that. So thank you, Kerry McWilliams. In the book, he takes direct aim at what he labels the Spanish fantasy past that was created by LA boosters, SoCal boosters, and its attendant whitewashing of Southern California's indigenous and Mexican past. So I want to return back to this, the countercultural movement that you bring up in the late 60s, with, muralism and then rise of, Chicano identity and politics, as this, if you want to call it countercultural, even, you know, reform at the ground roots level, if you will, visually. And so how Mexican Americans began to remake both place and identity then in Southern California after experiencing the racism and discrimination that had been both built into the environment, you know, structurally and physically, but then also culturally. And then how this is also at the same time they're trying to make sense of this process of their own heritage of of migration, right, and being binational. So I think this is where I want to get back to the muralism. So can you talk about the Chicano murals that started popping up in the 60s and the 70s? And I mean, you made this great point that you kind of make this as draw a comparison or a parallel between this, and you mentioned earlier, and, you know, the Anglo-Protestant mission and Spanish revivalism in Southern California, right? So can you talk about that a bit more? I thought it was just a great point and great chapter that made that connection.
Thank you. Yeah, no. Well, first off, yes, absolutely. We all stand on the shoulders of Kerry McWilliams when we write about the Spanish Arcadia or the Spanish Fantasy Pass mm-hmm. or any of these sorts of things. So in that sense, I mean, thanks to Carrie McWilliams, I mean, that was literally, I had the same moment you did where my head sort of exploded as a Californian reading it. I think where I think this is in no way a critique of Carrie McWilliams' work. I mean, it was crucial for its time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I think that where what's different about McWilliams and Chicanos and Chicanas that came after him was that McWilliams thought that by writing this expose, we mm-hmm. could lift the veil of the fantasy past. That if
right.
people just knew that the missions were, you know, as I mean, I think he compares them basically to Nazi death camps and these kinds
mm-hmm.
of things.
Right.
That if people just understood that we could do away with this fantasy past and people could really have a true sense of history.
Right.
And instead, what we see is a retooling of history. And I think for me, it was a moment in which I came to really understand the constructiveness of history, which is, you know, crucial to us as historians.
Right.
Especially public historians. Well, McWilliams, I think, was in some ways optimistic. What he hoped for didn't turn out at all. And in fact, we have the rise of this mural movement, I guess when it says the crown jewels would be places like Chicano Park
in San Diego, right?
Exactly, in San Diego. But, I mean, anywhere you go, you know,
right.
you're going to find murals that really transform place and contest and undermine the way that the story has been told, the very story that he was critiquing. But I think ultimately what that showed me was that these muralists, though critiquing Anglo-American dominance and claiming a legitimacy for a people that were denied that legitimacy by as a result of nativism, as racism, they were participating in the same language
mm-hmm.
of conquest and reconquest
right.
by using the indigenous tropes that came to them from Mexican nationals. I mean, that's not to say that people... that Chicanos and Chicanas, that we don't have indigenous blood, but
right.
mm-hmm. it becomes problematic to romanticize,
right.
say, the Aztec past when your ancestors may have been Tarahumaras and you didn't know.
right.
You know, so exactly. It's important to examine and critically reflect upon something, a movement that is also very legitimately making a counterculture and creating a culture that is deeply embedded within the context of the way that principally Anglo-Protestants, but that Anglos created a region and created a place and created a country. So I see the murals as really being part of the same picture.
Right.
That they can't be taken apart.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this goes to my own desire to, as I said, there's a certain desire for wholeness when you are straddling two different cultures and trying to understand, okay, so how does my American half or my U.S. half fit with my Mexican half?
Right.
And so I think that was ultimately where I was hoping to end up with this book, and I think that's why I end with this quote from Paz talking about how we all need to understand a whole range of histories in order to understand ourselves. We can't just stop with studying Chicano history. We have to understand Mexican history. We have to understand the history of the United States and colonial history and the history of Spain and the history of North Africa. And it doesn't
right.
stop. Yeah. In order to become as whole as we can.
No, that's a great point, and it's I think it's very true. And again, I just appreciate. I don't think I had read that somewhere else before. Just someone drawing the connection through actual, you know, the use of language and, you know, symbolism and iconography, right? That's rooted in religion and you know mm-hmm. other cultural ideas, you know, between both, you know, the oppression that ethnic Mexicans suffered here in the United States, but then also the way that they, the movement that was created to claim self-determination and to sort of, if you will, you know, right wrongs, also mm-hmm. in of itself, right, encompasses that mm-hmm. same or similar processes of, you know, remaking history that, you know, whitewashes or, you know, erases, you know, the uncomfortable or messy parts of history that don't fit your project, right, or mm-hmm. In political aim. So, and I think that is a very important point. It's something that it's one of the things that I love most about teaching history. It's what we try to do, right, as you show. Yeah. You try to show history from all these different angles, right, because it's not so easy. It's not so clear. Right? There aren't just these two black and white perspectives. There's really, again, all these intertwining histories and that some of them reuse. A lot of times these certain concepts or tropes are reused for different purposes mm-hmm. over time. So yeah. It's just a great point, you know, that thread that's carried throughout the book. So I appreciate you taking the time with us to discuss it.
Thank you.
I also wanted to, we're running out of time here, but I definitely mm-hmm. I'm very interested in hearing what it is that you're working on now. And, you know, mm-hmm. book wasn't published too long ago, just last year. Mm-hmm. But I kind of know the nature of you know, the academic track and push. And so, what is it you're working on now?
Well, I'm working on two things in terms of my academic work. One is I'm working on a series of essays again dealing with the historiography of the Southwest. Right now, I'm working on an essay on Willa Cather and the role that Death Comes for the Archbishop had in occluding the history of Santa Fe and critiquing her portrayal of Mexican Catholicism mm-hmm. as opposed to the French Catholicism of Bishop, in her book it's Bishop Latour, a fictionalized biography of Bishop Lammy. Where you have 19th century critiques of Catholics being laid on Mexican Catholics. That is to say, Mexican priests are hypersexual and they have illegitimate children and all these kinds of things. And Bishop Latour in the book is coming to sort of clean things up. And this book is embraced wholeheartedly by white American Catholics. And it's seen as being, you know, the most Catholic book of the 20th century, mm-hmm. Not written by a Catholic, but still it's being able to have this foil of the Mexican other, the Mexican that that takes on all of the negative things that were attributed to Catholicism and dividing up Catholics, good Catholics and bad Catholics. The good Catholics can be American, the bad Catholics, well, maybe not so much. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. Another thing that I've been working on, and I've just been dabbling, and I haven't gotten as far as I want to on this, but I will, is thinking about ritual and violence in narco violence, especially in Torreon, where I have a great deal of family and where the city has been completely transformed by violence and understanding. Why does the violence take the form it does, and getting a better sense of these sort of, I guess these are secular rituals of violence, trying to understand through the lens of religious studies, not necessarily saying that they're religious, but trying to understand how these things get routinized.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So there's that, and then what really keeps me busy is we've just started a new center on campus. It's called the Anderson Freeman Resource Center after first woman and man of color at Middlebury in the 19th century. Hmm. And it's a student resource center for underrepresented students, first-gen students to come and really lay claim to this very pristine and very elite small liberal arts college in a very white state.
Right.
So that can be a very difficult transition. Mm-hmm. So that's been a lot of what I've been doing. And as we were talking about earlier, it's sort of a form of trying to give back and trying to support the students that otherwise might not get to feel like this is home and
right.
take ownership of the place in a way that one would hope.
Well, and it's great that also, I mean, as we discussed, you kind of experienced that yourself. So I think you're really, as you mentioned, that giving back, you're able to really relate to some of that, you know, the disorienting process that it can be to, you know, go away to college, particularly if you're, you know, first generation or from, you know, a socioeconomic or cultural, ethnocultural background that just hasn't necessarily provided with the social capital, if you will,
right,
to know exactly how to exceed at very, you know, prestigious and competitive universities or colleges, right?
So right. Yeah.
That sounds great. That's wonderful. Well, thank you for sharing those projects with us. And again, I very much appreciate you coming on to New Books in Latino Studies and just wish you best of luck in those other projects. And hopefully maybe we'll get you back sometime to talk about
those
once they're done.
Absolutely. Great.
All right. Thanks again. Thank you for tuning in to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel. And I hope you have enjoyed my conversation today with Roberto Ramon Lint-Sagarena, author of Aztlán and Arcadia, Religion, Ethnicity, and the Creation of Place, published by New York University Press in 2014. If you'd like to contact us, you may send us an email at newbooksinlatinostudies@gmail.com. You may also watch for our weekly updates on Facebook. And we encourage you, of course, to get a copy of Roberto's book, and you may do that by following our links to Amazon on the page below. Thanks so much.